I think we are hitting a tipping point where the fear of the status quo and the fear of having yet another large IT failure is starting to overcome the fear of the new.
Hello and welcome to the brand new Public Impact Podcast, where we talk to people who are doing amazing things in the public sector to help break down barriers and find new and innovative ways to really make a difference. My name is Jonathan Messenger. I'm executive editor of Public Spend Forum, and I'm excited to introduce this episode because in terms of making a difference, you really can't find someone working harder than Code for America's executive director, Jennifer Palka. Public Spend Forum founder Raj Sharma and board member Shelley Kapoor Collins sat down to chat with Jen, and she talked about some of the amazing work her organization is doing, how things have changed in terms of taking risk in government, and how one word emblazoned on coffee mugs in Code for America's Oakland offices could change everything for the public sector. Here's Raj and Shelley talking with Code for America's Jen Palka.
Jen, thanks so much again for being here. It's a pleasure to speak with you again. You know, you are a woman at the cutting edge of tech, innovation, and public service. You've done so much, from founding CFA to your work as the deputy CTO at the White House to now coming back to the CFA. You know, out of your many impactful endeavors, and you've had many, again, can you tell us what excites you the most about innovation today?
Yes. It's a little hard to pick one thing because I think there's so much exciting that's going on. But I guess I would say that it has felt oftentimes like change happens slowly, 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 and then starts to happen fast. And I feel like that's the moment now for a lot of people who've been looking at how to make government technology work better. Certainly the creation of the United States Digital Service, 18F, which launched before that by several months and has been growing so fast, really put this on people's radar. And what's happened really in, I would say, procurement of government technology has been a lot of really well-intentioned people like us at Code for America sort of pointing out a problem and pointing to possible solutions. For a long time, I've been doing this for the past 5 or 6 years. But then it feels like with the momentum of the creation of those units in federal government, with the creation of many digital service units now in state and local government, and with this just increasing awareness that there's a better way and that the way we've been doing it has been hurting the American people, I think sort of at the end of last year, for me, the moment was the change in procurement for the child welfare system by the state of California. I felt like we finally hit a tipping point where this different approach to technology started to become mainstream. And it feels like, frankly, 5 or 6 years, at least in my own experience, of what felt like slow and frustrating progress turned a corner super fast. And now there's going to, I mean, it's not like everything's going to change overnight, but that there's a lot more momentum than there used to be. And that this stuff, you can see a path to a real mainstream change across the country in how we procure technology. And that, to me, is really exciting.
So that is, I think that is a fantastic answer. And it actually might segue nicely into one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about and go right into procurement specifically. While you're absolutely right, it's really exciting to see how we're turning the corner and organizations such as CFA are hacking the government procurement process. There are still $2 trillion that are being spent by local, state, and federal government through the traditional procurement process. And clearly, the government is starting to take an innovative approach to engaging these startups, Jen. For example, at the federal level yesterday, you probably saw that the GSA launched the Startup Springboard program, making it easier for smaller companies to provide tech services to the government. But, you know, out of everything that you just said, are there one or two specific changes that you would like to see happen that would be making a more substantial impact, right? We've turned the corner, but now where do we go?
Sure. So, I mean, there's a number of fronts here. just a couple days ago, before the GSA announced their fantastic program, I was at a launch event here in San Francisco where San Francisco, Oakland, San Leandro, and one other local Bay Area municipality had combined to, come together in a really similar program called Startup in Residence, where they're bringing small companies in, partnering with them really early on unique problems, and turning the procurement paradigm on its head. So instead of writing a big RFP and then hoping somebody can fulfill the very specific requirements of that RFP, they frame a problem and then allow companies to help them creatively solve those problems and build a company around it. We're going to get way, way better outcomes with this kind of approach. And I now see that happening much more consistently across the country. So that's true innovation. I think also there's a part of what needs to happen that we're going to call innovation, but what it really is doing what's considered pretty basic in the tech industry. We actually have mugs here at Code for America with the hashtag InnoBasics on them because we really think it's important to call out that sometimes innovation in government is just doing what has evolved to be very standard practice in the creation of, say, the consumer tech products and consumer internet. So one of those things, as I'm sure many of your listeners realize, it's been such a big sea change over the past couple of years, is just that when we develop technology, traditional procurement has asked us, again, to sort of create these incredibly detailed requirements documents. And that makes it impossible to use best practices from the tech industry, which at this point are pretty consistently the use of agile development. Agile development means that you can't know everything your software is going to do when you start, because you wouldn't then be able to co-create it with your users and end up with a product that actually gets used at much lower cost. So I think the thing that I would most like to really see spread would be the adoption of agile practices, both with vendors and with internal technology development in government. And when you see agile development work well in government, one of the things that happens that is absolutely transformative is that policymakers also realize that policy has to happen in an agile, user-centered, and data-driven way. And that's when we realize the true ambitions of this mission. It's not just about procurement. It's not just about agile. It's certainly not just about technology. I don't care about technology for technology's sake. I care about outcomes, and I care about serving the American public. And when you realize that it's not just about technology, it's really about good governing, then you realize that's what we're going for, and everybody is able to get on board with that by adopting agile practices in lots of different areas.
Wow, a lot of great things in there. Raj, I think Jen just said your two key words, good governance, good governing. So I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, if I could follow up on that, totally agree. This is about so much more than procurement and technology. It is ultimately about outcomes. What, from a good governing standpoint, I'm just curious, what are the types of things that need to happen? We know there are a set of institutional barriers that are in place, but what are some specific examples that you're seeing from a good governance standpoint that are starting to potentially enable more changes?
Well, actually, let me start with the story about what happened in California with the child welfare system. Would it be helpful to kind of go over what happened there?
Absolutely. I was actually going to follow up on that one. Curious to hear more about it, yes.
Yeah. I'll just tell you that story, and then we can talk about some of the ways in which we see this having follow-on effects, beyond technology and into governing. The child welfare system in California, the computer systems that should run all aspects of that system are woefully out of date. I don't think they're actually technically out of compliance with federal standards, but, more importantly, social workers have a very difficult job to do. Policy analysts have a very difficult job to do. Managers have a very difficult job to do, because there are 475,000 reports of abuse and neglect of children in California every year. Imagine how important it would be to have working software and fantastic data to help you manage those very unfortunate and heartbreaking cases the best of our ability in the 21st century. that's not how you could describe where California is with its software for child welfare. And they've been working for many years in a very traditional way to approach the creation of a new system. That means many years of requirements development. And in the summer last year, they asked us to look at the state of the RFP. We had some folks here from Code for America basically write an opinion on it. And what we said was, if you look at the very high rate of failure of IT projects in government overall, I mean, many people are saying it's 94 to 96%, you're already very likely not to succeed with this project. And in fact, California has a string of very large, expensive IT projects that haven't worked. This is not news to them. But that project in particular had all the hallmarks of failure, like the size of it, the extremely detailed requirements, and the sort of the way in which it was built to fulfill requirements and not to fulfill user needs. A document that will govern how the state and its vendors are going to evaluate each other in the collaboration to create the software really has to show a remarkable level of understanding of the needs of the users of the software. And a traditional requirements gathering process doesn't do this. So we gave them some warning that we thought the different approach was important to happen. It was very hard for them to take that advice because it's very hard to feel like there's any other option when you work in government. But over the course of the fall, Todd Park, who was my boss when he was the CTO in the White House, came to Sacramento. We talked about how these other options, these other models of working in a user-centered, data-driven, and iterative way are getting real results in government. And the folks in California, I mean, the government operations office, the health and human services folks, the folks in, the office of the chief information officer in California had to make a really, really hard decision, and they had to take a big risk, and they showed enormous courage by finally saying, no, we must put this RFP out as scheduled by the day before Thanksgiving. But despite all the work that's gone into it, we are going to take a radically new approach. And we are going to, with the advice of our team and some folks that came in from 18F who do this procurement consulting professionally, and this is a service that they provide to federal agencies, and we got them to come do it for a state agency because this issue was such a big one and frankly a moral issue that we serve the kids of California better. They instead put out a very small RFP that preferences user needs, requires agile development, requires the use of open source and open components where available, and has a far greater chance of success than the previous approach. And more importantly, what the folks in California said was, if we're going to take the huge risk to do this in this case, we're going to do this everywhere. We're going to start requiring agile, modular, smaller RFPs where we can attract a vendor ecosystem that's great at technology and great at user interface, not just a vendor ecosystem that's great at getting contracts. And it's just been remarkable to see how, while many folks assumed that this would cause a lot of pain and suffering for the people in government who are taking the risk, they've been energized, excited, positive, hopeful, rallying around this sort of unknown territory that they're entering and saying, this is the future of government. We're all in. Let's make it happen. And it's just been wonderful to see.
I'm just curious. You said people kind of jumped on board and they're excited now. Did you see, you know, some fear in the beginning of that process and I'm guessing some pushback? And how long did that take to overcome?
So we always see that. And speaking to Shelley's point earlier, I think we are hitting a tipping point where the fear of the status quo and the fear of having yet another large IT failure is starting to overcome the fear of the new. And I think we were in a unique position that while, of course, there was some fear and anxiety, which is very natural, and frankly, to be, you know, respectful of the folks that have that fear, it's a fear of not using public dollars well. These are people who are trying to do their best, right? While you still have that fear, we had the advantage of, frankly, what I think a lot of people would say is a moral issue, right? Mm-hmm. This is the one place where we can't look at ourselves in the mirror 5 years from now and say, we didn't do what everything we could possibly do to make a system that helps kids in California not be abused and neglected. I think that's what pushed it over the hump.
Yeah. No, it's such an important cause too. Shelley, you probably have some follow up. One last one I have is, where is it in the process right now?
What happened in the end of last year was that they put out two smaller RFPs. One was essentially for an API to wrap around their existing system, and the other one was for just the case management system. They then held a vendor forum for the case management, for both RFPs, I believe, on December 4th. And where they are right now is working with the vendors who have submitted, I don't believe it's their full bids, but have submitted their intentions to work with and some of their partnerships and their credentials, and are working through that process. That RFP has not been awarded yet. The state, I believe, will be putting out the RFP for the next module pretty soon, though I don't recall exactly when that's coming out. It has been very interesting to see that this RFP attracted a set of vendors that would not have ever bid on the very, very large RFP. The original RFP was going to be about a $500 and $600 million bid to start. And you really could have only got, very large established systems integrators. And I think we're going to see a lot of systems integrators still bid on this. And I think some of them are going to put their agile teams on it. And it's going to help those very large companies build out their skunk works, their agile teams, and get good at this new way of working. So this isn't about preferencing smaller vendors over larger vendors. But if you look at the mix of folks who came to the table, and if you assume that re-energizing the vendor ecosystem and putting new people in there, giving smaller companies a chance to bid on this stuff, smaller companies who have a good track record, then I think it's definitely showing that these different kinds of RFPs will attract different vendors in a different vendor mix. And a lot of them were actually the companies that spun out of the healthcare.gov rescue. They're the folks that came in and actually fixed the site, not the folks that were responsible for the original failure of healthcare.gov.
Hope not.
The folks that came in primarily from Silicon Valley and said, hey, we can do this and we can make companies around it. And I love that those folks are sticking around and re-energizing the vendor ecosystem.
So that's a really great point, and I have a follow-up question to that piece specifically. Companies spun out of that, fixing healthcare.gov, and so they had a natural segue into working with the government. And I love the startup springboard idea that the GSA has put out in engaging these smaller companies. But Jen, what about that entry point, right? Just getting through the funnel to being able to work with the government, to getting on the radar. If I were a small company listening to this right now, I would say, how do I get in? How do I even get started? Some insight on that?
Well, I would say that 5 years ago, nobody knew how to answer that question. And now there's no easy answer, but you can look around and see dozens, hundreds of companies who are figuring out that right answer for them. I would also say it continues to be a process, and we still have to get better at it. Let's celebrate our success, but not stop holding people's feet to the fire about making it easier. It's still very hard to work with government as compared to working with private clients. I was at the STIR launch the other day, which is San Francisco Startup and Residence Program, where the keynote speaker was somebody who had started. It was a small company that started working with San Francisco in sort of the earlier iteration of this STIR program to bring in new companies. And he had helped create a very innovative solution for helping blind people navigate through the airport. And they have installed this, and it's actually working in sort of a pilot in San Francisco Airport right now, and much lower cost and very high return, a wonderful system. But one of the things this entrepreneur had to say was that it was both a positive experience and a very negative experience, because they'd worked out up to and including sort of the pilot and showing that this was a much better solution. And then they hit a year and a half or 2 years of just, okay, now we've got to go through a regular procurement and nothing can happen, which if you're a small business is not good for you. You can't, you've got people sitting around. And if you're a very, very large business, you're deploying them on different things, and it's not as financially devastating. But small businesses can't take two-year delays. What I said to that, and what the other folks said to that, is just as we need companies to come to the table and bring agile, iterative processes to government, so does government need to be iterative in it. And the first iteration of that program had a flaw in it, which is that they hadn't figured out how to, once they did find a good solution, fast-track those companies through a streamlined procurement process. The good news is the second iteration does. Now that they're working with these 13 new companies, they have seen that as a problem and fixed it. And we need to be tolerant with government as it iterates and improves over time, just as we expect our products to iterate over time.
And I think that's great, because at least there's that recognition in the government that this needs to happen, right? Like, as you know, like you said, shifting the procurement paradigm from a technology standpoint, but from a policy standpoint. And what a great point earlier you made, that the use of technology and spending the public's money really is a moral duty of our government officials and electeds. And that's how they have to approach it.
Well, you know, we have one final question. Like we said at the beginning, you know, partly we believe and the all the great examples you provided that, you know, there's change happening in government. But you're talking about examples where citizens can really, it's really a collaboration between government and citizen and organizations and suppliers. If you have any advice for our audience in terms of, you know, one or two things they can start doing today that anybody can start doing, what would it be?
I'm so glad you asked the question. People do need to get involved. We all need to get involved. We all have to own the problem of government working better for us. And the ways that you can do that now are so much more diverse than they were 5 years ago. Certainly for people in the tech industry, the biggest thing I would say is to consider that a stint in government, at least, is absolutely necessary for your career to be complete. You should not think of your impact in the world as being significant if you have not gone and worked in federal, state, or local government and really contributed, but also really understood the challenges that government faces and become a better citizen because of that and held government accountable better because of it. You don't have to be a technologist to have a big impact in government. I think everybody who understands implicitly this value on starting with users, iterating and following data. I mean, I'm not a technologist and I get this. Can have a great leadership role or a great contributor role in government by just being a voice for the user. So I think everybody ought to think about a much more emphasis on public service as a big part of your career. But you can also do this as a volunteer. You don't need to be in government. You can work with the Code for America brigades. We have about 50,000 volunteers around the country that go to local meetups. They do apps for their local communities. They do user testing of other apps. They advocate for open data. And they eventually will be, I think, very effective at advocating for procurement reform, though we haven't made that enough of a priority right now. And again, you don't need to be technical to do that. You can be a community organizer. You can be a communicator. It's so important that government have the community around them as part of their capacity to get things done, not just holding them accountable, that that's important, but also saying, hey, it's not just a stick that we sort of beat you with from time to time. We're a carrot. We're part of getting the things done that government is supposed to do. So I think really just an awareness that government isn't this other thing. It is us. Mm-hmm. If we're not involved, we can't complain. And finding a way to do that, whether it's in your career, outside of your career, or just going down and showing up at City Hall meetings. There's no excuse today, and everyone should know that.
Thank you so much to Jennifer Palka. So many great insights and examples there of how people can really make a difference with just a few small changes in their approach. To find out more about all the great work Code for America is doing, go to codeforamerica.org. And if you'd like to find out more about Public Spend Forum, you can find us at publicspendforum.net. The Public Impact Podcast is produced by Raj Sharma, Shelley Kapoor Collins, Frank McNally, and me. I'm Jonathan Messenger. Our theme music was produced by True Grit Music out of Austin, Texas. Thanks again for listening. And if you know a story we should be highlighting here or someone we should be talking to, please send an email to stories@publicspendforum.net. I would love to hear from you.